How do we help clients who interpret their feelings of resistance as a sign to stop therapy? According to Dr. Kelly McGonigal, this is a common experience, especially among certain personality types. Here, Kelly offers a three-step plan that can help refocus the treatment while disrupting resistance.
People think that they need to listen to that voice or that resistance as some kind of wisdom. And so in all of the courses and workshops I teach where people are trying to make a change, I actually ask them to identify it. Maybe we'll put a name to it, like, who is this person who wants to block you from making the change? And to actually share sort of what the thoughts are, what the excuses are, what the experience of resistance feels like. Again, so people start to see, oh, okay, this is what happens when I commit to something that might be difficult or that might require me to change in some way. And another thing that I often do to try to, so in terms of like who is most likely to feel this kind of resistance, I have found that people who really, really value autonomy are most likely to deal with this, again, even when it's freely chosen, but especially if it's unfolding in some kind of supportive context, like in therapy or in a class, or you and your spouse have decided to make some change together. That as soon as that change is unfolding in any kind of supportive context, there are a lot of people who are so motivated by autonomy that they actually experience social support as social control. And no matter how positive the intention is behind that support, people start to feel like they're being judged, they're being criticized, they're being controlled, their freedoms are being taken away. And so I wanted to share an exercise that I learned from the motivational interviewing body of work about how someone who wants to support someone in making a change might begin to support the autonomy and a little bit sidestep that kind of reactance that often comes up. And this is called, it's a three-step brief action plan. And it's often delivered in therapeutic or medical contexts, you know, a doctor who's trying to help a patient improve their health in some way. And it basically works like this. When you have a couple of minutes near the end of an appointment, you say, by the way, you know, I'm curious, is there anything that you would like to do in the next couple of weeks that might support your health? Is there anything that you're thinking about? You know, you can ask the question a lot of different ways, but the idea is the question has to be asked from a true sense of curiosity. You don't have an agenda. You're not hoping they're going to say something that you want to, you know, them to do. But is there something that you're thinking about or something that you might want to do? See what comes up. Help the person articulate what that is. And then the second part of this brief action plan is you say, okay, what do you think are some obstacles? Like how strongly do you feel like you're actually going to be able to do this? Can you imagine any barriers that might come up? And so you're actually priming the part of them who now is going to be looking for the obstacles or the barriers. And so it's like you're harnessing that reactance now, not against you for suggesting they do something good for themselves, but against what are those barriers going to be? What are those obstacles going to be? And you can actually harness the sense of not wanting to be controlled. So now you're pointing it at what's going to get in your way. And people can get a little fired up about that. Like, okay, yeah, what might get in my way? And then the last part of the brief action plan is there anything you want to do with me that would support you? Like, do you want to check in? Or is there someone else in your life that might like do this with you? And you just sort of invite the possibility of that kind of social support sort of after you've tried to back away from the sense of social control. And I found that sort of approach, even if you're not doing it in that technical way, it's a technique that one might use. Even if you start to learn to talk to people in that way, what are you thinking about doing? What do you think might give you an experience of? And then whatever it is that people are working toward, what do you think might get in the way of that? And then finally, do you want to check in about this in a couple of weeks? Is there some way I can support this? Or of course, if you have an ongoing relationship with someone, then you can check in and you can simply do it by asking, how's it going?
You know, it's interesting. You talk about the support is sometimes instigating the desire for autonomy or the resistance. But in many times, particularly with dieting, we encourage people to have a buddy or, you know, or something. And, I wonder if that's always a good idea.
I think it is almost always a good idea, but there are probably a lot of ways to do it that are going to be, I think you need to think strategically about how you do it. So I often will definitely frame it as not somebody who is going to be controlling you, but it's somebody who shares your goal, and now it's part of your job to support them. So it's like a peer coaching, peer mentoring kind of thing, rather than people always say that they want, you know, a buddy or support system for accountability. But in my experience of facilitating support buddies, people aren't actually looking for external accountability in the same way that I think we sometimes talk about it. That external accountability can very much trigger this kind of reactance or resistance. And I've actually, it's funny, I've even seen people, so when I assign people to be a support buddy, first of all, I always ask them if they want to, right? It's totally autonomous choice if you want to participate. And then there are always some people who end up having to, you know, they ignore their support buddy, they never answer emails. And at the end, we make it an exercise in resistance. And I actually ask people, what I'd like you to do now, if you are someone who did not, who signed up and then did not do this, you didn't answer the email or you didn't support your buddy, how did that process happen? How did the process of not doing it happen? And, you know, people can often see that it's, well, suddenly, as soon as I said I was going to do it, I didn't have time for it, I didn't want to do it. And sometimes it's easier for them to see that process of resistance to the support buddy, and then recognize how that same process is unfolding in whatever the bigger changes that they wanted to make. But I think we should just be aware of it almost, you know, this thing of resistance, it comes up in response to almost everything. And so that's going to include even, you know, having the support.
I appreciated that insight about clients who may interpret social support as social control. Now, like Kelly, practitioner and author Bill O'Hanlon has also encountered resistance in his work. But as we hear next, Bill often resolves these resistant feelings with two powerful techniques.
So this guy comes in to see me, and he tells me that he's been referred by a friend of his who was one of my clients, and he lives 4 hours away. And his friend basically twisted his arm saying, go and see this guy, because you're more messed up than I was. That was his line. And so his friend reluctantly comes to see me and he said, the reason I'm reluctant is I've tried everything. I've been in 9 years of psychoanalysis. I've been in group therapy. I've been in couples therapy. I've been in cognitive therapy. I've tried medications. I mean, he gave me the whole list, you know, the typical person who would be seen as resistant by most therapists at this point, because he'd have this big, thick case file and he tried everything and nothing worked. So he said, my problem is I have severe obsessive compulsive disorder. In fact, the guy who treated me for 9 years, the psychoanalyst, had written a book on obsessive compulsive disorders. And he told me one time during treatment, I had the worst case of OCD he'd ever seen. And that didn't seem like a curse to him. He was a little competitive. He seemed kind of proud. I had the worst case. He couldn't solve that. And he was the expert. So I withheld judgment whether it was the worst case that I had ever seen. But it was mostly obsessions. And from the moment he woke up to the moment he went to sleep, he would have intrusive obsessions. I won't go into all the details, but basically they spoiled his life. He couldn't enjoy things anymore because he would be so distracted by these sometimes terribly gross obsessions, and sometimes just overanalyzing obsessions would get in the way of conversations and enjoyment of a movie or reading a book. He just couldn't get into it anymore. And so, you know, I said, well, you know, I'd like to try hypnosis because I think it'd be good for this based on what I knew about treatment. And he said, oh, I've already tried hypnosis. I can't do it because I obsess about what the hypnotist is saying and I overanalyze their words and I can't relax and go into trance. I've tried it. I go, well, I have a different approach to hypnosis. So I do this approach to hypnosis. And indeed, he has a lot of trouble at first, but then he seems to go into trance pretty well. And pretty soon he goes into a really deep trance and a really good trance. And he comes out and he says, wow, this is the first time in 20 years I haven't obsessed. I go, what? He goes, I don't know how you did it, but I want to come back again. So he comes back again, and I start doing the trance the next time, and he says, he just pops his eyes open while he's in the middle of the trance. He says, there, do more of that. He said, forget trance. I realize the trance isn't helping me. That, what you just did, is helping me. I said, well, what I was doing was hypnosis. He said, no, no, not hypnosis, that. And we went back and forth, and finally he told me this thing. He said, what you're saying, somehow you surround every moment I'm trying to get rid of what's happening inside me. And what, how you're saying this, however you're saying it, the way you just said that, I can't do anything wrong. And that, he said, I would drive 6 hours to get 2 minutes of that. So what I had said, different from what, again, most traditional hypnotists do, I say, you can let your obsessions be there. You can have, you can be distracted. And then I saw him start to tense up, and I say, you can be tense and you can go into trance. I just started to include everything he thought shouldn't be and couldn't be included. Everything he thought was wrong with him, you know, or that he was doing wrong, I just included it all by giving permission for it. So I have three methods of dissolving resistance, if you will. Give permission. And there are two kinds of permission. One is it's okay to, and the next is you don't have to. So it's okay to obsess, and you don't have to obsess. You can be listening and paying attention to what I'm saying, and you can be distracted, and you don't have to pay attention to what I'm saying. So two kinds of permissions. It's okay to, you don't have to. And that's about feelings, thoughts, your being. It's not always about action, because I wouldn't say you can kill yourself. That's a permission I wouldn't give. It's a permission for destructive action. But any internal experience, thoughts, images, feelings, sensations, perception, who you are, giving permission for that, those two kinds of permissions. It's okay to be gay. When the person finally gets that permission, either from a therapist, maybe they might say, or from society where other people say, you're not weird, you're not crazy, it's not bad, that would be a powerful permission. And for years, society did not give that permission. Sometimes therapists did, and sometimes therapists were part of judging people and saying, that's a craziness, that's an illness, that's a sickness, and you have to cure it. So that's not, that's the opposite of permission. And I think that creates resistance. A lot of those people who went to therapists in the 50s, where they were trying to be cured of homosexuality, they were seen as resistant. And I think that's the therapist's issue of judging the being of the person, who they are at core, you know, whatever. And gay is just one example, but many other examples, like it's okay to want something for yourself. It's okay to be frightened. And so those are emotional or being kind of states, you know, whatever. All right. So permission is the first way that I dissolve resistance if it shows up like that. Give me those two kinds of permissions. The second one is a little more complex, and it's a little more non-rational. That is to have two seemingly opposite feelings or states of being or thoughts at the same time. So let me give you an example. I had a couple that came to see me, and their child had been murdered as an adult. And their friends had all gathered around and supported them for a while. And then because it was a gruesome case and the legal case went on, they caught the person who did it, and there were, you know, terrible, terrible things were going on. Their friends sort of gradually were either giving them the message, time to move on. You know, we don't want to deal with this. It's too gruesome. It's too terrible. It's too grief, you know, filled. But they couldn't move on, because they were still in the middle of it, both in the legal case and in the grief. And around Christmas, their friends really all left them alone. And they sort of split off from their friends. And it was just the two of them. After a couple of years, they started to have trouble in their marriage because they were relying on each other for every need to be met. So they came to see me. And one time, they were getting back out socially. And they said their biggest fear was their friends would think they were over this. And they said, you lose a kid, you never get over it. And so they went to a party, and they found each other laughing. And on the way home, they talked about it, and they said, now our friends are going to think we're over because they saw us laughing for the first time in a couple of years. And I said, well, maybe you can just tell them, we'll never get over this, and we're moving on. They were like, say that again. They were really excited. They wanted to write it down because they wanted to memorize that. It seemed like opposites. They'll never get over it, and they're moving on. Or even they'll never get over it and they're getting over it. So the second level of dissolving resistance is to allow, give people permission to feel two seemingly opposite things. They hate their partner, they love their partner. They forget what happened in their abuse and they remember what happened in their abuse. These opposite things, to be able to include them at the same moment, that's a powerful way that I technique that I use to dissolve resistance.
As Bill shared, when clients feel that they have permission to have their resistance, it can lead to greater feelings of empowerment. For another take on holding these kinds of ambivalent thoughts, here's Dr. Ron Siegel.
I often do a little thing with audiences of asking therapists, how many of you listen to NPR and National Public Radio, which is our, for those of you from overseas, that's our kind of educational radio program. And, a lot of the hands go up because therapists are educated and they're curious people. And then I ask, well, how many of you drive or aspire to drive a Hummer? And very few hands go up. Once, I think one hand went up, so we have our own ways of saying, I'm this kind of person, not that kind of person. And to really embrace ambivalence means embracing, well, both, in so many different ways. I'm a generous but also selfish person. I'm a smart person but also a foolish person. I'm a saint and I'm a sinner. And, we see that all the world's great religious traditions have said, you kind of do have to embrace both. You'll know better than I am, but it's something like, let he who is without sin cast the first stone, right? I think is in Christian traditions. And there's a wonderful poem by Thich Nhat Hanh that this reminded me of. And I quickly looked it up to just quote one stanza, and it's called Call Me By My True Names. And just one stanza says, I'm the 12-year-old girl, refugee on a small boat, who throws herself into the ocean after being raped by a sea pirate. And I am the pirate, my heart not yet capable of seeing and loving. And there are other stanzas too, but that gives you, a flavor of it. And I think this is our task in embracing ambivalence. It really means not only noticing our different feelings, but loosening up our sense of our stories about who we are and being one kind of person or another.
Like Ron said, clients can find a sort of freedom by opening up to this kind of duality of thought. In the next module, we'll look at how to approach the sub-personalities that often drive a person's resistance. I'll see you there.